you have to believe that something is attainable in order to fight for it. If you don't believe it's attainable, even in your deepest heart of hearts, then you can't fight for it.
Drive with Christ before the world.
What does it mean to fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
So here I am with Michelle Achdut.
Shai, thank you so much for having me, first of all. And like I say all the time, the way that we met when I first heard you giving a speech, it was indoors, not that famous speech that went beyond viral, but you gave a speech, where was that?
At the JCC.
I think. I just, something about the way that you were just raw and emotional and real, and I heard the pain in your voice. But I also heard the courage and, you know, the amount of bravery that you had to give that speech. I just knew that I had to get to know you, and then getting to know you intensified that, you know, that whole feeling. And I mean, I'll tell anybody every day, the way that you put your life on the line for this fight is something that's beyond admirable. And I'm sure it's lonely sometimes, and I'm sure it's terrifying sometimes. But you know that you have me, and you know that you have an army behind you. I shouldn't even say behind you, with you, alongside you. And that's how we all have to keep going. You know, every day, the same way that I say, you know, in our world, as a director of a Jewish civil rights movement, which we'll talk much more about, but in the world of End Jew Hatred, the Jewish civil rights movement, is that it's all about walking alongside each other as we fight this fight, to embrace civil rights, to embrace Jewish civil rights, not just Jews walking with Jews, but everybody walking with Jews to fight this fight. So you know that I'm here for you, and we're here for you, and I'm blessed to know you and your wife and your delicious kids.
Well, I couldn't do this without you, Michelle.
Really.
But before we start, and we are going to delve into all of this, Michelle, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, what kind of a Jew? What a great question. What kind of a Jew am I? I am extremely Zionistic, unwaveringly so. I am an Iranian Jew, which I think brings a whole nother dimension in terms of knowing what my forefathers have been through and my own parents have been through, seeing the upheaval in Iran. They were born there, but seeing the, you know, overthrowing of the government, the revolution, I think that brings a whole nother dimension of knowing what, you know, what the fight is and what Jews are dealing with in different countries all the time. But that is that Zionism and that strength. I'm a strong Jew. I'm a traditional Jew.
What does that mean?
Traditional. So in the sense that not so much, you know, I'm not Orthodox. I've been born traditional, conservative, but the traditions are, again, this is the, I think, the Sephardic Iranian in me. We never go out on Friday nights where it's family time. It's tradition. We light the candles, tradition. We keep quasi-kosher, meaning just, you know, sort of eating vegetarian out, quasi-kosher, but that's tradition. So I would term myself a traditional Jew in the sense that we do things almost without question because it's what we've been born and raised to do. And if we do start questioning them, that's okay also. And just as I tell my own children, question. If you decide that, for instance, you don't want to keep kosher or it's not as important to you and you find your tradition in another way, as long as you maintain that strong Jewish Zionistic identity, you're going to be your own kind of Jew and you're going to blaze your own path.
It's interesting you'd say that. I see you as a strong Jew. I see you as a Zionist Jew. I see you as an Iranian Jew, and we'll talk about that more. I don't see anything traditional about you. You went to business school at NYU. You then worked for a while, then had kids and realized, you know, I'm going to stay at home. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you're like, you know what? I am going to end Jew hatred. Cool. And you just started this thing,
right.
And that's not traditional at all. That's fighting against.
Oh, yes. No. So that, in terms of that, I guess I mean traditional in the family sense, traditional in the maintaining certain custom sense, you know, so that type of Jewry, mm-hmm. I mean, when I say traditional. But as a human being, as Michelle Achdut, the human being, I don't think I'm necessarily traditional because I'll fight until I'm, you know, blue in the face to fight the good fight. I have, you know, I have sort of that unwavering sense of self that I know I can tell what's right and what's wrong. I'm very practical, sensible. And I think that's where I bring, you know, a lot of strength in fighting this fight, that I'm able to objectively look at things and really, you know, pragmatically figure out right, wrong. Let's err on the side of right and try to make things happen.
All right, let's err on the side of right. So what is Andrew Hatred? Tell me, you know.
Sure, let me get into
How does a traditional Jew end up running the first, the only Jewish civil rights movement?
This wasn't my baby. It's a baby that now I'm enjoying raising and sort of, you know, taking to the next level. But this was, you know, the brainchild of Brooke Goldstein. Brooke Goldstein, who's the executive director of the Lawfare Project. So, you know, she's an attorney, started the Lawfare Project now, I believe it's about 15 years ago.
And what is the Lawfare?
Lawfare Project is a pro bono civil rights litigation fund representing victims of anti-Semitism. So that's just incredible work to begin with. There's four full-time attorneys and now a network, I believe, of about 800 that are ready to represent victims at no cost, you know, pro bono, when they are wronged, both on college campuses, workplace, you name it, and they take care of it. Now let's backtrack to COVID era, Black Lives Matter era, for lack of a better term. Brooke really would, you know, she sort of looked out her window and would see the Black Lives Matter protests going on, speaking their mind, being heard on a different level. And it hit her that there is no Jewish civil rights movement. So this was her brainchild. This is now about 3.5 years ago. Commissioned a deep dive study into civil rights movements, what makes them tick, what works, what doesn't work, and really came up with the name and Jew Hatred. It's loud, it's in your face, it's necessary. So, you know, both the name and then how to try to embrace everybody to fight this fight, as I said, you know, a couple of minutes ago, realizing the same way that we walked with everyone gladly so, and we continue to do so, all we're asking is for everybody to walk alongside us and just embrace Jewish civil rights, meaning differentiating 1,000,000%, yes, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, but somebody who wants to embrace Jewish civil rights doesn't need to be well-versed in every single aspect of the history of Israel and, you know, what's going on there and what has happened there for the past X amount of years. They need to understand what civil rights are, that civil rights include being able to walk across the quad at Columbia and not getting spit on for wearing a yarmulke because somebody associates you with being a, you know, Zionist baby killer. That's civil rights being infringed upon. Mm-hmm. Civil rights, we've seen now a lot of infringements the past 8 months, sadly, but that's the goal. The goal is really ensuring that civil rights are upheld, just basic fundamental civil rights. And since I've been on board, so now it's about 2.5 years, we are just taking things to a different level in terms of building allies, building allyship, forging different, you know, unity and waking up everybody. That's the key. The key is people were awake. People are more awake now. So ensuring that now that people are awake, people are acting.
But why did it take so long? What you know, Jews have been in the United States for about 300 years.
Yep.
There has been civil rights movement for many minorities, and an important civil rights movement for many, many minorities.
Absolutely.
Why now? What happened?
That's the billion-dollar question, Shai. Why now? Look, I mean, you saw a glimpse of it, Soviet Jewry. You saw that sort of the loud, proud, that piece of things, you know, that we had the marches.
You mean the prisoners of Zion?
Yes. So yeah. I mean, so that, yes. But why was there not a strong, a Jewish civil rights movement until literally 3.5 years ago is a question I don't know the answer to. I don't know, is it that have Jews just been too busy, tikkun olam, sort of taking care of the world, taking care of others to focus on themselves? Have we not maybe been sleeping at the wheel a little bit, not realizing the need for a Jewish civil rights movement, which now everybody realizes the need for? It sort of might have been the perfect storm of everything that there just wasn't one. But thankfully, there is one now. And the goal, as I said, is, you know, that the unity, Achdut, my last name, that unity is the most important thing, right?
And I should note that your maiden name is Ohev Shalom.
Yes,
right, lover of peace.
Yeah, it's
so your full name
you
is
can't beat that.
Michelle Ohev Shalom Achdut, which
exactly.
is Michelle lover of peace and unity.
It's pretty
right?
crazy.
but okay, so what's been the reaction? So you've been with Andrew Hatred for
it's about 2.5 years.
2.5 years, and I see you everywhere. I mean, I see you, but I also see Andrew Hatred everywhere.
Yes, so I'll tell you that. I guess the easiest way to say this is pre-10/7, we had some people awake. Andrew Hatred was on the map. We were building partnerships with different grassroots organizations, for instance. We were holding different rallies, different action. You know, when I say actions, you know, the goal of Andrew Hatred, as I said, is social pressure. You know, it's really applying social pressure on issues to create systemic change.
And how do you do that? I know you send action items every day.
Yeah, well,
now
exactly. So pre-10/7, we didn't do so much this, what I call digital activism. It was more on the ground rallying, knowing that we have the Lawfare Project attorneys in our back pocket if things cross over into the legal realm. So perfect example was CUNY Law. CUNY Law, we've known who Nurdin Kiswani is for the past...
Unfortunately, I should say Nardine Kiswani is the head of Within Our Lifetime,
correct.
Which I have been calling a domestic terror organization, which was before they rebranded as Within Our Lifetime.
Exactly.
It was Students for Justice in Palestine, NYC.
Exactly. Yeah. So Nardine Kiswani was a student at CUNY Law. This now goes back, I think, 2.5 years ago. She threatened to set someone's sweatshirt on fire, an IDF sweatshirt that another student was wearing with a lighter. She just did horrific things that there were not consequences for at CUNY Law. So much so, no consequences, that she was then given a platform at the commencement ceremony in 2022 to speak there. She spewed her garbage, I mean, you know, again, horrific lines.
We should note about Nardine Kiswani also that she, you know, people would know her. I mean, you and I have been following her for
yes.
a while and being scared of what she's doing and what
yes.
she stands for. But people would know her. She's the one that led the protests outside of the Nova
exactly,
Festival Exhibit Memorial.
Yes.
She led the one in the Sloan Kettering
yes.
Cancer
and,
Ward.
And Shai, more than that, she led in 2021 a bunch of protests that resulted in, for instance, when Joey Borgen was you know, brutally attacked, that was following one of these Within Our Lifetime, if you want to call it a protest, but, you know,
it was their members. Yeah.
Exactly. So back to CUNY Law, though. So she was given a platform to speak at commencement, which is pretty horrific. Following the next year, 2023, Fatima Mohammed, another Jew hater who has spewed horrific, you know, just sentiments about both Israel and you name it, she said it. She was given a platform at commencement. So CUNY Law was a huge problem. We reached out to the chancellor. We went and we rallied outside the chancellor's office 2 times. So for those rallies, the goal was putting a spotlight on the chancellor, getting, let's say, a meeting with the chancellor, letting them know that we're watching them. But pre-10/7, Shai, it was hard to get even 100 people out at these rallies because it wasn't their problem. Even in my own circles, when I would try to tell people, come out, this is happening. This is happening at CUNY Law right here in New York. I was met with a lot of CUNY. My kids aren't at CUNY. My kids are at UPenn. My kids are at, you know, at Yale. It's not my problem. And it's not something that touches my heart.
And I should note, I mean, we shouldn't make feel, you know, I'm sure a lot of people watching this or listening to us might feel a bit judged by it because they were
right.
also not there. And
right.
to be honest, I wasn't there. It's not that I didn't see it as my problem. I just didn't see it.
100%.
I was not aware. I mean,
absolutely.
And if I did, it was very few glimpses. I didn't understand how big
a
problem it was.
Exactly. Okay. So what you're saying is exactly it. And that is what I say. And I would never judge anybody back then for not coming out or not knowing, but it's that post-10/7 life, this is the silver lining, is that people are awake. Sad that we need to be awake. Sad that I even need to be doing this. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's very sad that I need to be a director at a Jewish civil rights movement and Jew hatred, but this is the world. But Shai, so post 10/7, people are awake. People realize, yes, what was happening at CUNY Law was sort of the bubbling surface of what has been going on. Just as you said, you know, Columbia, just as you, when you spoke at Congress last week, it wasn't a switch that was flipped on 10/7. We know that this has been a problem with Columbia for years. You know, this is like true systemic Jew hatred and anti-Semitism that is, you know, just sort of coursing through the veins of a lot of these universities. But what we have going for us now is that people are awake, people are activated to help in any way they can, to be an activist in any way they can. And that's what now we offer. When I say offer as a movement, we offer different ways for people to be active.
But I do, I want to know a word you keep going back to, which is very interesting. You say people are awake, right?
Yeah.
We're now awake. It sounds very similar to what people were saying in 2016 and 2020 in the BLM movement. Right. And I differentiate between the idea of Black Lives Matter, which is for me an obvious idea, and then the movement, the organizations, which is very problematic. But they also said people are now awake, and that's where woke came from.
Uh-huh. So that's a whole other thing.
You know, but
so let's say activated. I don't know if we need to say awake.
It seems it's an interesting thing because I do feel like many Jews still need to wake up, right? So we end up using very similar ideas,
right,
but with much different goals.
Yeah, that's right? Actually super interesting what you just said.
Yeah.
And I think it's on point. But so let's even say, if I say activated, so there are a lot of Jews.
I think if we start saying Jews were activated, then all the anti-Semites would say, "You see, elders of Zion, right?
Oh my God.
They're activating Jews."
Oh my goodness.
That's the thing. I mean, it really points to a big problem that we have, which is when people speak about civil rights, the language that people use, the ideas that people use, it's been extremely exclusionary of one specific minority. I'm not saying that maybe other minorities feel the same. I'm not dissing that. I'm not minimizing it.
Right.
But I can speak as someone who's experiencing as Jewish that we don't even have the language. They didn't even allow us to use the language.
Right, and that's it. But now we're using it, Shai. That's it. I think now what we're coming at this with is that loud and proud, it's our time now. And what I say to so many people, it's go time. That's really what this is all about. Now's our time to A, be heard, B, 100% peaceful, but unwaveringly proud. And we need to be loud and speak our minds and fight for justice. We need to fight for our justice. We need to fight for what we know is right. So that goes into now these letter writing campaigns and the activism, digital activism, as I call it in that way. And you know, what we've seen there is pretty tremendous. What we've seen over the past 8 months, I know you might be familiar with the whole concept, but if anyone's not, I'll just explain. Essentially, we have anyone that believes in Jewish civil rights is a part of the End Jew Hatred movement. It's as simple as that. You are a member of the End Jew Hatred movement.
You don't need to pay dues. You don't need to.
Zero.
I mean, it's a great t-shirt, but you don't have to wear the t-shirt.
No, and we even give the t-shirts out for free, frankly. Everyone says, "Do we need to pay you?" And I'm like, no, this is just part of me. So
you decide that you're part of the civil rights movements for Jewish civil rights, and you are.
You are a member of the End Jew Hatred movement. And when I say that, everybody could and should be a member, regardless if you're African American, Asian, regardless of background, regardless of religion. Everybody should want to be behind civil rights. That's our core fundamental belief, and we are getting there, and we will get there. But that being said, so the digital activism piece incorporates, we have so many volunteers now, volunteer attorneys that are helping to draft letters on a daily basis, letters to both look into deplatforming Jew hatred, and also thanking allies when good things happen. And I think that's super important. So every day I will send out to our WhatsApp networks. I man about, I think, 6,000 people now via WhatsApp. But then we also have grassroots partner orgs that have their own WhatsApp channels, and we all cross-collaborate. So we're reaching about 30,000, 40,000 people a day in these channels with letters to send regarding XYZ. You know, one, just one example of a letter, for example, yeah, one quick example was at WashU a couple of months ago. There's a professor there, Professor Gustafsson, who applauded the smoke bombing of the AIPAC president's house in LA. Ugh. So it was literal, you know, terrorism on his house, or crime, let's say.
See, what I don't crime. Understand about yeah. these kind of professors, they could keep their mouth shut.
That's it.
You, I don't even ask you to love me. I don't ask you to respect me or even accept me.
Right.
Just keep your mouth shut. You don't need to applaud terrorism.
Literally applauded. So applauded this, if you want to call it hate crime, vandalism, terrorism, whatever anyone wants to call it, you should not be applauding it and saying that someone that justifies baby killing shouldn't be allowed to live in peace. Insane. So we got to work. We had our amazing volunteer attorneys draft a letter to Chancellor Martin of WashU, saying, hey, this is going on, and this professor should not have free rein to teach in class and mar people's minds with what definitely will not be in any way neutral. And then we did find out, and when I say got that letter out, we get that link out to thousands of people, and everybody sends on their own. So Chancellor Martin may very well have gotten 20,000 emails, if people change them a little bit or not, but they're pre-populated emails. That's pressure right there. That's maximum pressure, as I said, peaceful, but maximum pressure on a social level. And we found out a week later, via an article of Professor Gustafsson sort of crying about it, that he was being supervised in his class. Mm-hmm. So that's a win. You know, something like that is a win. We're not going to move the needle. A tenured professor, I'm not saying that he would right away get, you know, completely canned. I live in the real world, but that's just one example of.
But that's not, that doesn't seem like it's our goal. It's not that we're trying to retaliate. We're just trying to have consequences for hate,
exactly.
Consequences for infringement of jewish civil rights.
That's it. And really, you know, holding people accountable and having these consequences create change, because ultimately that's what we want. We want our kids to be able to go to school. I mean, you know this as better than I do, I'm sure, but want them to go to school and not be indoctrinated. We want them to go learn, become critical thinkers, 100%. But critical thinkers coming from the viewpoint of someone who is, if you want to call it political, positional neutrality, I wouldn't even call it political, positional neutrality. So allow kids to be free thinkers, but on their own terms when presented with facts. Not skewed and not with this, you know, horrific indoctrination. And again, you know, so much of what you said the other day at the congressional hearing resonated with me, you know, talking about the fact that kids are scared to write papers for fear of getting a failing grade if it's not what the professor wants to hear. How is that in any world okay? That to me is a fundamental infringement on that child's civil rights. They're not afforded the right to speak their mind and, you know, sort of hand in what they should be able to hand in a free world to get a grade that reflects the quality of their work, as opposed to just being silenced and giving a professor what they want to hear. It's insane.
Yeah, it really is. It reduces the person to a mouthpiece.
Really?
And that is unfortunate. But you keep referring to digital activism.
Yes.
You know, there are people that might say, is that really activism? Like, is it not just like feel good?
But it is activism. That's it. You know, Shai, that's my biggest thing, is that everyone can be activists in their own way. That's sort of what I go with and I truly believe in my heart. Not everybody will feel as comfortable as you or I, and I'm throwing you in this with me, even if it's not full comfort, but might not go into a crowd in front of Columbia while
not everyone can. Some people have physical disabilities, some people have busy and they work.
And then there's busy work, physical disabilities, and some people might just not feel comfortable doing that. And that's okay. And that's why by providing other platforms for activism, that's where we're coming from. So the digital activism piece does work every week. At the end of each week, I procure a list of wins for the week. And every week there's a good 6, 7, 8, 9 big wins. And it's beautiful, you know? So something like that, we do, I'm very big on that whole move the needle. We're moving the needle on Jew hatred. We are. It's a slow and steady, you know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. But while we're moving that needle, the key is ensuring that we have pride while doing so. Pride, and that we hold each other up and we blaze ahead.
So full disclosure,
yeah.
Every day, my wife, Yarden, she completes the action items. a few days ago, she was calling senators about the Deterrent Act.
Right.
You know, she signs the letter, she sends emails. What kind of feedback do you get from your digital activists?
Incredible. So that to me is probably the most heartwarming piece of this entire story, if you will. I get, so the way that the action items groups are run, it's admin only. So we don't have crazy chatter back and forth because we all know when WhatsApp groups can get off the rails crazy. So we've structured that it's just me sending out actions, but people could reply privately to me, just not within the group. So the amount of feedback I get, I don't want to exaggerate. I would say weekly, probably 20 to 30 separate texts from people thanking us for giving them something to do, thanking us for making activism easy, and thanking us for informing them. And it's beautiful. Not that I need thanking and patting on the back. It's not that. But it's that feeling of unity and that feeling that even if within all of our networks, we have people on the right, on the left, in the middle, that all of that goes out the window, and the eye on the prize is ending Jew hatred, and the eye on the prize is, you know, just making sure that our civil rights are upheld. And that's the beautiful piece. And I've gotten messages about that. I've also gotten messages about the group chats that we have that are open and that do get off the rails, right, left, yelling, this, that I feel like a babysitter at times. But let's put that aside, because all I keep trying to just drill into everyone's mind is keep your eye on the prize. And I think thousands are, and it's beautiful. And the messages I get of them thanking us when it's us thanking them, because these are our volunteer activists that are moving the needle and making such change. It's beautiful.
I love it. You mentioned the open groups, and I'm obviously in many, many WhatsApp groups, and some of them get off the rails. But I tell people, if you want to break out of the political echo chamber in the United States, join a Jewish WhatsApp group.
Right? Such a good one.
You know, you might be in a Jewish echo chamber, but you can have like MAGA Trumpists, you have Bidens, you have independents. You obviously don't have a lot of Jill Steins or Bernie Sanders, you know, you have many, many different views on, and we disagree, but we get along.
That's it, Shai. Like to me, in the open groups, the beauty comes, and I'm getting the chills just thinking about it, the beauty comes when we hear about the hostage rescue, that no matter where anybody stands in those groups, we're all together. When we hear, you know, when we hear something that we know we're all on beyond the same page, it's the most heartwarming concept. And I also have non-Jews in these WhatsApp groups.
Yeah.
I have, you know, there was just last week, amazing, an Asian gentleman reached out to me saying how thankful he is for this and how it reminds him of when he stands up for Asian hate. I mean, this is beautiful. It's not at all just a Jewish echo chamber. It's for everybody that just has a heart and believes in decency and standing up for what's right.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool.
And what do you do, or what do you say to people that say, look, Jew hatred has always been around.
Mm-hmm.
It will always be around. You cannot end Jew hatred.
Very valid saying for someone to say that. We have to believe that we could end Jew hatred to fight the fight. That's it. It goes back to, is anything impossible? No, impossible has I'm possible in it. It's the same concept.
Oh, come on. I'm going to have to edit that out. No cliches.
That was hysterical. That was very like something I would say, tell my children.
But
really, you know what? It just comes down to that you have to believe that something is attainable in order to fight for it. If you don't believe it's attainable, even in your deepest heart of hearts, then you can't fight for it. So yes, is ending Jew hatred black white not likely? Okay, one can say that. But let's just call the Jew hatred out for what it is and want to end it, and we'll get damn close to doing so if we keep growing at the rate we're growing and if we keep seeing the passion and buy-in from activists worldwide.
Right. It clearly, when you talk about a civil rights movement, and what I love about whenever I talk with you and you start talking about the bigger picture, your eyes light up.
Yeah.
And you know, and comparisons are always fraught. There's always, you know, if you make any comparison, people will hate you, people will love you. But it's hard not to make the comparison to the civil rights movements of the 1960s. Yeah. And it was actually, you know, it's a misnomer. It wasn't a civil rights movement. It was African-American civil rights movement, right? Which is important and not taking away anything from it. Yeah. That's what it was focused on. And in fact, Martin Luther King was then trying to turn it into an economic civil rights movement. And that was his last speech before he got shot. Right. But his, you know, the most famous speech that he gave in Washington is, "I have a dream." Mm-hmm. And his dream was that basically racism in the United States ends. We're not there. Hopefully one day we will be there. But when you tell people that's the dream, they'll be like, yes, one day we will get there. Why is it so hard for us Jews to say, I have a dream of a day with no Jew hatred? That, like, in the back of our minds, we know that it will exist.
Yes, that's very true.
It doesn't mean that we can't, we should keep fighting.
Yes.
But in the back of our minds, we know that it will still be there.
I mean, Shai, I think it's just because for how many years has it been there, and has there been a cycle of it? The lull and then the peak, the Spanish Inquisition. You know, I mean, look, we're talking centuries, Shai. So centuries of it existing, but us persevering is where we know that it will exist. We know that we have to do whatever we can to fight it. But more than anything, we know that we just have to have this drive and fire and passion to mitigate it as much as we can. That's the best I can say, because we know it has always existed. It just rears its ugly head, you know, certain times reaches that boiling point and then subsides with hard work, or, you know, reaches again and then subsides. But right now we're seeing something that is making all of us, in our lifetime at least, in my lifetime at least, that I have not seen before. Mm-hmm. And we just have to do our damn best to fight it.
Right. And it's my impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that demographically, the majority of activists in Jew hatred and the people that I see in the protests and the people that I see online tend to be women.
Is that
a correct observation?
It is a correct observation, which is very interesting. But I don't know if it's sort of just like female strength and, you know, that powerful, you know, go women, go. Or it's also a function of, for instance, a lot of our volunteer attorneys are attorneys that took time off after having children. Mm. So, you know, they're amazing, brilliant, but have the time to donate on a volunteer level, which is incredible. So I sort of don't know which came first, the, you know, chicken or the egg, but we take it and we run with it. And then, I mean, we have some awesome men that are just juggling crazy amounts of, you know, both work with their what they're volunteering and showing up and helping to plan rallies and protests. So they're there also, and God bless them.
I'm not trying to dissuade any male, but it's interesting.
You're right, 100%. I'm thinking right now, even the other leaders of other grassroots groups, these other WhatsApp chats that we, you know, cross share info with, they're actually all women. There's about five other WhatsApp groups that, you know, that are combined. We have about 40,000 people. And they're all head up by women.
It reminds me a bit of the movement in Israel in the 1990s to end the war in Lebanon. Okay. And it was called Four Mothers. Mothers of fallen soldiers who decided, we are going to stop this.
That's
for our sons and daughters. And they were four mothers, and also they were on a play on the four mothers, the biblical ancestral mothers. And it just, there's something about women, mothers or non-mothers, who see this for what it is, but are not afraid to call it out. And maybe it's also because of the nature of the sexual crimes that happened on October 7th.
That 100%, I mean, 100%. I think that that's on point what you're saying. And look, and I think it's also not taking anything away from paternal instinct, but I think it's also maternal instincts. Looking at your kid, looking at your child, and thinking, what is the future going to look like for my baby? And thinking to yourself, I'm going to make damn sure that it's a good one, or as good as we could help make it. You know, so that might also be something, you know, playing into.
So now, so another, you know, another demographic question, and Iranian women.
Totally. It's
right. Amazing. I can, off the top of my head, you know, obviously you, Talia Dror, Shirin Yediger, her daughter, who's, you know, the head of SSI at Columbia. Yeah. Why Iranian people?
It's interesting. So we actually have spoken about this a lot in our own family, because I have four children, but my older two daughters are at Duke. They're on the college campus fighting the fight. Thankfully, Duke actually has been one of the better campuses relatively.
And I would say, but for people that are not seeing, you just air quoted, you know, because like when we say better, it's like, thank you for not, right, you know, burning it down. Like that's not, better is not good. Yes. But it is better. Yeah,
exactly. But so, and they are both what you would call loud, proud. We've talked about the fact that, and so my older daughter's friends, so many of them are these other Iranian females. So, I mean, I could, as you said, Eden Yadigar, Yasmino Hepsion from Tulane, Eden from Columbia, Sahar from Yale. I know that I'm missing, because they're Talia yes. Dor from Cornell. But so there's that whole piece. And then there's the my generation piece that, forget about me, but we have Shirin Yadigar, Sheila Nazarian, loud. We have other, you know, influencers who are very loud on socials, you know, from Persian Jewish. I mean, you name them, and yeah, it's sort
but
of
why?
These loud. So it's, I think it's just, this I could say is pretty clear cut. We know what the Iranian revolution looked like. We know what oppression can bring and what not standing up for yourselves can bring. Again, not at all placing any blame on my parents' generation or, you know, the generations before us, but we have in our core being, we've seen what college campuses looked like and how everything started from college campuses back then. That's where the Iranian revolution began, on college campuses, point blank. So I think seeing and knowing the history from our own parents and from our own family members, seeing Iran fall from glory, seeing what transpired there, I think gives us, just as I said, the whole maternal instinct piece, gives us a whole different viewpoint on how important it is to stand tall, stand proud, and not cower and be afraid. We have no choice, Shai.
And what do you feel about things like the Ayatollah praising American students in their protests and illegal encampments?
I think that just shows the sad state of affairs that we're in, that these students that are in these encampments have just become... I say this very openly, that I don't think many of these protesters are evil. I don't think that they're evil. I don't even necessarily think some of them... I don't think they're all Jew haters. I think that they've sadly been so brainwashed to think that they are fighting a good fight. They've sadly been so brainwashed to think that not even Israel, I'm going to put Israel out of the equation, that Jews are Goliath and non-Jews specifically, you know, in this fight, let's say the Palestinians or Arabs are David. They've just been so sadly brainwashed that they don't know better. And I keep using the term useful idiots, because that really is what they've become.
Yeah, I always, when people ask me, like, are they bad people?
Right.
And I say, if you march for 8 months screaming to globalize the Intifada, you either don't know what you're shouting or you don't care, which makes you either stupid or evil.
Thank you. So
and I'm not
exactly
going to say, and I'm not going to decide for these students, for these protesters, what they are, but they tell me, do you want to be stupid or do you want to be evil? Like, if you, and if you are uneducated, we don't expect people to come to college educated, but at least acknowledge that you're uneducated and be open to hearing the other side here being Jews telling you, you are calling for our demise.
Exactly. No, that's exactly what it is. I mean, look, we all saw those videos of when people ask what river to what sea, or those interviews that Zach Sage does on Instagram. I mean, it's so much of it is just showing true ignorance. But when you get back to the Ayatollah praising the encampments, how ignorant can you get? And these are supposed to be our best and our brightest and the future of our country. And that to me is what's terrifying. What's terrifying is that these institutions that are supposedly elite are breeding grounds for hate.
Yeah.
The student governments are even more breeding grounds for hate. And when you have student governments at these Ivy Leagues and these top, again, I'm air quoting, these top elite institutions that likely are interested in government, interested in politics, and might be the future senators and congressmen and women of our nation, that's what's terrifying.
Yeah, I would say we're not the brightest, we're not the best, we're definitely the richest. That's how I think about students in these universities. So what does the future hold for Jews in America and for the fight for Jewish civil rights?
I have to hope that the future is, it's going to be a tough mountain to climb, but we're climbing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot hinges on policy. A lot is going to hinge both on policy, and a lot is going to hinge on lawsuits to create change. Mm-hmm. That's what it, I think those are two fundamental pieces. So policy, as you know, when you spoke up at Congress, figuring out the Deterrent Act, getting that passed, ensuring that universities.
And I would say the Deterrent Act is basically a transparency on
a foreign funding,
to universities.
Right. And it lowers the threshold of what a university needs to disclose. And when it's coming from a country of questionable standing, I'm not sure what the exact terminology is, then even any amount over $0 has to be disclosed. So that transparency is a huge piece.
That seems common sense.
Common sense. Oh. And that so many things, Oshai, is things that should be common sense just aren't, and right. It doesn't make sense. So I think that's one big piece, but I also do think that specifically on the college campus arena, lawsuits are going to mm-hmm. make a big difference.
So policy and
lawsuits.
Basically, we're going to win this fight in Congress and in courts. For someone young, high school or college student, maybe a parent who is trying to understand what constitutes an infringement, into a lawsuit. So what would you tell them and who should they talk to?
I think that's actually, it's an amazing question and a very important question. We've held probably so far post 10-7 about 6-7 big Zoom sessions around exactly that, because it's sometimes very difficult to delineate that social arena as opposed to legal arena. And that's where the best way that I could sort of, I guess put this out is free speech is free speech. And we know hate speech is hate speech, but there are a lot of times I'm fielding probably about 100 texts from either parents of children on college campuses, parents with kids in K-12, dealing with, hey, this happened to my child. How is this okay? Can we do something about it? So it's the what happened. If someone, for instance, yells Free Palestine in your face as you're walking across campus, that makes you very uncomfortable and it's not okay. But something like
right away,
that,
if someone comes in my face and yells anything, would make me uncomfortable.
Correct. Uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's not about the Free Palestine.
Exactly,
it's the getting in my face.
Getting in your face. But there are a lot of times when someone might think that something is legally actionable and it is not, because it doesn't have sort of all those factors of, there's a difference of someone getting in your face and yelling, as you said, makes you uncomfortable. There's a difference of that as opposed to somebody blocking the entrance to your building to go take your science final,
which is illegal.
Exactly. That is a very different take than there's discomfort and then there's preventing you from going about your daily life and from doing what you need to be, has to get done. So what we do on our end, though, is end Jew hatred is that social piece. People will constantly, because I'm so accessible via text, will text me, But then I will farm that out to my attorneys if it's something that I feel is legally actionable. And then separately, the Lawfare Project has on their website a civil rights campus form, basically, where anybody could fill out, and it goes directly to the, you know, intake of the attorneys. If they feel that their civil rights may have been violated, they can explain exactly what transpired, and then our attorneys will be able to assess, hey, is this legally actionable? If it is, they'll contact them. If it's not, the beauty is that then I'll get wind of it, and I will see if it's something that End Jew Hatred could apply social pressure for.
Yes.
And then that's where either it's letting them know they should go to the Office of Institutional Equity, go speak to a dean, speak to the provost, or does it warrant a big click and sign letter campaign?
Or a protest or a rally or whatever.
Exactly.
So and we will make sure to have like the link to the Lawfare Project here, so for the episode info, so that people can know. Because look, my hope for you is that you don't get 100 messages, you get 10,000 messages, not because there's more anti-Semitism in the world, it's because people start waking up or activated, and we actually exact change.
Yep.
Do you have any book or movie recommendation for people who want to educate themselves about Jews, Israel, Jewish civil rights?
It's a great question. I would say two things. One is actually a movie that Brooke Goldstein herself made about 15 years ago. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's called Making of a Martyr. It's crazy to watch. And it's interesting that it centers on a 15-year-old Palestinian boy that was about to partake on a suicide mission. Mm-hmm. And right before he was about to blow himself up, he turned himself in. And she went to the West Bank. She interviewed him, family members, terrorists. I mean, insanity. But the reason why I think it's so relevant to the whole concept of civil rights. So put Jewish civil rights aside. But the beauty of it is that it focuses on how Palestinian civil rights are taken away by, you know, the horrific Hamas and the horrific terrorists that are brainwashing these kids from when they're born to believe that martyrdom is something beautiful to aspire to, and they're stripping themselves of their basic fundamental civil rights. So I think it's a really important take on looking at the world of civil rights in a very, you know, harsh and horrific way, to then hone in on civil rights are of paramount importance, and let's also look into, you know, the Jewish civil rights piece. And then separately, Barry Weiss happens to be one of my favorite human beings, and she wrote a book a few years ago, How to Fight Anti-Semitism, and there's some great info in there about sort of addressing the anti-Semitism, the Jew hatred on all the way on the left and all the way on the right. So it's the identification of it, but then assessing how are some ways that we might be able to fight it. And in there, there's a lot of information about what constitutes, you know, your own basic fundamental rights, what is okay, what's not okay. And it's a good book to read.
No, I completely agree. That's a great book. And it does get to a really good job of showing the different types of anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And
really
the understanding
is
that it's not a political thing. The left will not save us, and the right will not save us. Only if we work with them together will we be able to save this.
Absolutely.
So,
should I ask you a question?
Yes,
hey.
Please. We have time.
Do we have time for me?
Yes. Yes, please.
So I
told you to, you know, prepare questions, and I said like
I
will answer honestly.
It's a good question.
Well, I'll decide if it's a good one.
No, it's a good one. So no, actually, it's because I was going to actually call you about it. That's why I think it's a good question. But I'm Mayor Adams, okay? Last week, you railed him for inaction, right? And it was interesting because I flip-flop on the issue, on him a lot. I flip-flop. I don't know what to make of, you know, I feel like his heart's in the right place. He says the right words. But then when you see what is going on and what is bubbling up to be even bigger and bigger problem, it's a huge issue. And I think one of the videos you posted, you were raw, you were angry.
Yeah.
And I saw that you had a lot of people agreeing and you had a lot of people disagreeing.
Which is very important
to me. Which is very important. Yeah. So I guess my question to you is, in a perfect world, a reasonable perfect world, what do you think action would look like from him? What would
So first of all, I would say, I don't call it flip-flopping. You know, we're still trying to make our minds up about all of these politicians. And, you know, I speak about Eric Adams because he's the mayor in the city where I live and where my kids grow up, go to school in public schools. So it's directly relevant to me. If I was living in a different city, I would talk about the mayor in a different city. It's, and like I say, it's not personal. I don't care if he's a Democrat or Republican.
No, I know, nothing. I love that. I know you made that clear.
I feel like politicians in general get so used to the habit of campaigning, because that's how the system works, that they forget that while they're in office, they're supposed to first do their job and second campaign. And someone like Mayor Eric Adams, someone like the governor of New York, someone like other mayors and governors have done amazing public relations for the Jewish people and for Israel. They've either gone to Israel and see what was happening. They've given amazing speeches. And I am extremely grateful for that, because they set the moral tone for the nation or for wherever we are. But that's not their role. That's not their job. When Mayor Eric Adams went to the Nova Festival exhibit after Within Our Lifetime protested it, he said something like, it's all of our jobs to speak up. And I said, no, it's my job to speak up. It's your job to speak up. It's his job to act, not to speak up. And there are many, many different things. Now, do I expect him to infringe on Nadine Keswani's civil rights? No, of course not. She also has civil rights, but she's fully, you know, she should have all of them. But there are many, many other issues in New York City that they can start with. We have anti-Semitic books for like kindergartners in the New York public library system. We have schools with teachers, with principals that have made horrific remarks against Jews, against Israel, and they are in charge of Jewish students. He can deal with that. We have issues where people are waving Hezbollah flag, the Hamas flag. You can bring them into questioning. I'm not saying arrest them, but if you have someone celebrating and promoting terrorism on American soil in New York City, you might want to examine that. There are many, many different things, and I would prefer that Mayor Adams, the governor, whoever it is, will wait 2, 3, 4, 5 days before giving a speech, but then their speech would be about what I have done, rather than, oh, this is a disgrace. Okay. Now, look.
Valid point.
They have a difficult job. It's way easier to speak up. Not that it's easy. I am suffering a lot for it, but it's easier to speak up. But I didn't choose the job of being a mayor. If you choose the job of being a mayor, then you should then you should do it. Now, of course, I have to say, I'm not saying we shouldn't work with them. It's not, and I'm always open to work with anyone, but I'm also going to hold people accountable to their words if they're leaders.
Very fair.
So now we're going to do something that I call a Jewish, but thank you for the question. Good question. Okay, so something that I'm calling the Jewish lightning round.
Mm-hmm. Let's go.
You can feel free to close your eyes if you want to, or I just look for your immediate
instinct
answer, and you get one pass. You can get a pass if you want to, and I'll decide if you get it.
Oh my God.
All right, so Michelle, what is one thing that people do not know about you?
Do not know about me. I'm deathly allergic to almonds, so if you ever want to poison me, spike my food with almonds.
As the leader of the Jewish civil rights movement, you probably should not let people know that.
It's Jewish lightning round.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
One thing people don't know about the Jews. I think our kryptonite could be silence. And that's what we need to ensure that we, you know, strive to overcome.
Mm. Yeah. What is your favorite curse?
Fuck. It is. Can you use it? It's like.
But can you say it like, imagine like you just dropped your favorite glass of coffee, it broke, it shattered.
Oh, fuck.
Okay.
And then the amount of times that it's what the fuck the past 8 months.
Yes, what the fuck.
Yeah.
When was the last time you cried?
Oh, great question. I'm thinking it was post. The last time I cried was last Thursday, but totally not Jewish related. My 13-year-old daughter called crying that she didn't do well on a test she studied really, really, really hard for. So when I saw her, I hugged her, and we were both just crying together for about 10 seconds, and then we strengthened. You know, I said, get strong and move on and be bigger and better than you were before. So
some would say that that's very Jewish.
That's maybe. And fun fact, Shai, through 4 years of college, I never shed a tear. And my friends thought something was wrong with me. It was sort of like a Seinfeld episode that I just didn't know how to cry. But I guess as I've gotten older and post kids, everything changes. So I cry now. I cry pretty easily.
We'll cry together. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Any moment in history?
Yes.
Golda Meir.
Why?
I just want to pick her brain. I want to learn from her. I want to hear from her. I want to... Golda Meir. It's not even a question to me.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Rosh Hashanah.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom Kippur. I hate it. I love food. It doesn't look like it, maybe, but I eat a lot, and I dread Yom Kippur from one Yom Kippur to the next. It's the biggest joke in my family. My husband thinks I'm crazy.
When do you feel safest?
With my family, with my four kids and my husband. When we're together, even just around the dinner table. It's just safe, warmth, comfort, the best.
When do you feel least safe?
Such a great question. I don't know. I don't know if I ever don't feel safe. I think if anything, I would say if I'm out in the middle of these protesters, let's say in front of Columbia, or, but I don't even let that get to me much. And it might even be a not such a smart way of thinking, but a lot of times I'm pretty fearless.
Yeah, you have your kick-ass aviator sunglasses.
That always.
You got your megaphone.
Let's see. God willing, I won't ever change that thinking because something has happened, but I feel pretty safe. And I think it all boils down to, the strong bedrock of my husband, my kids, my parents, my siblings. Thank God. I just have a very strong foundation that I think gives me just crazy bravery.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. That's something that we all need. Yeah. What gives you hope?
What gives me hope? See, I know I'm sounding like a broken record, but seeing everybody activated in a way that they have not been before is very hopeful. And it's a beautiful silver lining of a horrific time. You know, that's the one thing that I think has come out of 10-7. That's something just spectacular to see. And I'm hopeful for that.
And finally, in every episode, I urge listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week? And I'll say End Jew Hatred.
Let's put End Jew Hatred aside. I think this week I would say Brothers for Life. It has my heart. It's just wounded combat soldiers from the IDF. They pair them up with older brothers that have also been through similar situations during their service. And the way that I've seen that they give them strength to not only continue living but to thrive is insane. They, you see soldiers, ex-soldiers with prosthetic limbs climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. You see, they just help.
And they help them. They help them start businesses. They help them through school.
Through school, getting the most amazing surgery with top doctors. Even if as amazing as the government is and the funding is, if the government can't subsidize, the top physician for some sort of crazy surgery, they'll.
Or we should say it's the government in Israel.
Yes. Yeah. So
Brothers for Life. Chaim l'chaim.
Yes.
Michelle, where can people find you and Andrew Hatred, and how can they join the daily action
Great
items?
Great question. So one, we're on Instagram. I mean, in terms of socials, Andrew Hatred, one word. You could always find me and DM me. And that's how I'll give you the WhatsApp link to join the action items. And it's a world that once you join, you're going to thank me for it. And then, of course, online, endjewhatred.com. We have amazing programs that we haven't even touched upon, college campus fellowship programs, which is just empowering the next generation. And so if anybody listening is either a student or has a college student, it just really embraces that whole concept of empowerment and serving as a conduit to really get everybody on campus ready to stand up for themselves, knowing that they don't need to know historical facts. And, you know, it's not hard to be strong. It shouldn't be hard to be strong. So our campus fellows really, you know, embrace that, and we'd love people to look into that more. So definitely reach out on Instagram.
And I've definitely worked with several of them, and they've been incredible.
No, it's important.
Well, Shy. Thank you so much for having, for joining us, joining me here. And here I am with Michelle Achdut.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Shy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shy's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shy Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shy's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."